Welcome to the Future of Political Consulting by the AAPC, where we explore the evolving landscape of political consulting in a rapidly changing world. The AAPC is a bipartisan membership organization that represents professionals working in the political consulting industry. Our host today is Jackie Huelbig, Vice President at Basis Technologies, known for her leadership in helping campaigns leverage technology to better connect with voters and drive impactful results. Jackie will be leading the discussion with Paul Westcott, Executive Vice President of Sales and Marketing at L2, a premier provider of highly accurate and detailed voter data for political campaigns, advocacy groups, and elected officials across the country. Together, Jackie and Paul will explore the science and strategy behind data-driven voter outreach, where the industry is headed, and how campaigns can identify and motivate voters who are most likely to return their ballots in the final lead-up to Election Day. Jackie, take it away.
Great. Hey, Paul, how are you? Good morning.
Hey, Jackie. Very well. How are you?
Great. This is really exciting. We've got a few weeks left to go, and let's dive into how we find those hard-to-reach voters and those voters that just haven't made up their mind yet. So from my years of working with you and love L2, L2's been in the voter data space for 50 years, which is wild. How have the fundamentals of voter targeting changed in that time? I mean, we already know from taking offline to online, but some more of those nuances.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's fundamentally changed. I've been with L2 now for 10 years, and it's fundamentally changed in that period of time. So L2, when we started in the 70s, we basically were, and I say we, I wasn't alive at that point in time, but it was labels and lists. And what we did was we printed mailing labels and printed lists to do door knocking, to do walk sheets for door knocking, and then mailing labels. And so it was very simplified and basic processing, and only a handful of states at that point in time had a voter file compiled in a good way to be able to do this kind of work. With the Help America Vote Act and other things like that into the late 90s, as well as in the early 2000s, it made it possible for us to compile a nationwide file far easier. So we were able to go around. Each state had to do its own compilations. Some states took longer than others. So we were at the county level in a lot of cases. So just the basic data collection changed. And so then now you all of a sudden said, okay, well, we have name, address, vote history, some partisanship, some ethnicity. How do we fill in those gaps? And that's when you start working with commercial data. And the commercial data has been invaluable in terms of really filling in gaps to allow researchers, anybody doing any kind of targeting, to be able to go out and say, okay, I not only want to find Democratic women, but I want to find those that are 18 to 24 who might be undecided among those Democratic women. So how do we narrow that down? And the extra attributes are what make that possible. And of course, now we're in a world where, you know, when I started with L2, I think our data dictionary was 360 fields, something like that. We're now over 1,000. So it's a whole new world of targeting and outreach. And really, you know, practitioners such as yourself and the clients you work with, they are now diving into the data in a way themselves, even without some of the analysts and, you know, the analytics firms that are doing extremely high level work. But even without those, they're able to really drill down to these sort of niche audiences and, you know, do some advanced targeting.
Well, on a side note, your heat maps are priceless as far as being able to pull those audiences and visually show our clients where these people are, not just talk about where they are. On that note, looking at today's landscape, there are a ton of innovations and turning points and changes in the way that we reach voters. Can you pinpoint a specific technology or a moment in your last 10 years at L2 where you say, wow, this is going to change the way we use this file, or this is going to change the way our clients target people?
Yeah, there's been revolutions in technology. I would say, you know, one you just mentioned, which is the visualization. So having the ability to visualize, make selections, and then be able to see on a map. And this isn't just L2. I mean, well, I've seen practitioners take even our file and put it into an OpenGIS or something like that, where they're able to map and visualize and sort of see heat maps of exactly where their voters are. And that's being able to do that is something that really tells a story that you may not be able to get from a spreadsheet, right? So that's going to be a huge change in technology. And I highly recommend it. Even if you're not working with us, go look on a map, look and see where people are, and you might be surprised with some of the results in your district. The other piece is really the sort of offline to online technology bridge that's been gapped. I mean, L2 started with LiveRamp in 2015. We were the first voter file onboarded with them. And basically having an onboard to be able to distribute the data to, you know, at the time, dozens and now hundreds of different platforms is really something that was unique. And now it's you have to be there because it's what consumer marketers are doing and other things like that. But in the political space, it was certainly novel at the time. But to be able to take this really important raw material we have in politics, which is the voter file, and make it digitally targetable and accessible that's revolutionary. And I think that watching the evolution of that over the next 5 to 10 years is going to be very interesting as well, with a combination of regulations meeting new technologies.
Yeah. Do you feel like every time there's one step forward, there's possibly two steps back? Like once the match rate starting to go up, there's a scare about cookies, or the match rate starting to go up and there's a privacy law in California, Washington, things like that. So, but it's still a great tool to use. And I'm very excited, like you said, to see where this is going to go and how that's going to change the way we use that data.
Mm.
From traditional demographics to today's behavioral data, which we'll also dive into hyperlocal later, what are some of the major data-driven shifts you've observed while at L2? And does this improve the accuracy of the file and voter targeting over time?
Yeah, looking at new data is always helpful, and seeing an additional source is helpful. And one of the things I've noticed sort of at the top end of the data field in our space, in my opinion, is going to be the analytics firms. So on the left, you have Haystack, you have Blue Labs, and on the right, you have Causeway and WPA and all those. So you've got these different analytics firms that are doing this amazing work with data, and they're bringing in a whole bunch of different, they're bringing in us, obviously, like voter file data providers, but they're also going to additional consumer providers. They're finding niche providers on top of that. And sort of the mantra has become, now that it's cheaper and easier to maintain large scale databases, and there's just more technologists and people who can do this, what's really cool is that you can bring in, and what we're doing is we're out there hunting all the time for new data sets to not only, some of them are really sort of front forward facing, like, oh, we need more veterans, or we need more cell phones, or we need more things in our database that, you know, fill it out. But also those sort of QA type things to make sure that the data is accurate. So in California, there are some counties that are really sparse on apartment numbers. I mean, that's fundamental. You want to make sure you're householding people correctly. So we're buying apartment number data. We're doing things like comparing to two national commercial sources to make sure that the file's clean and accurate. So it's things like that. It's kind of like when you fix your HVAC system in your house. It's not super sexy. It's not a curb appeal type thing. But what it's going to give you is the sort of the bones, the structure of it, that's really going to improve the value and the quality of the file.
That HVAC analogy hit real close to home.
I just had to replace one too. It's horrendous. So, yeah.
So on that note, not the HVAC, but filtering out the segments and kind of the not necessarily the voters, but the Haystack data, let's say, and how often or how quickly does a subject come up that y'all are need to all of a sudden create a segment or manipulate the data? We were just talking about the hurricanes hitting Florida. Is there going to be a segment around that?
Right. Yeah. I mean, so this is the first year we will have done a third update of Haystack of the models that we did release right at the beginning of September, or really mid-September. And the reason for that was the Biden-Harris announcement. Obviously, that was a fundamental shift in politics. And the way we do our modeling is response-driven. So we had to get responses. We had to go out and field surveys, and or Haystack did, and get those data back, and then be able to match it and model it over the file. And then we had to ingest it into our systems that are into LiveRamp and Snowflake and all the other places where it has to live. So it seems straightforward and something where you can move quickly, but there's certain, you know, technological restrictions that make it a little bit cumbersome. But at the end of the day, we've gotten to a point where we can quickly field surveys. We can use panel-based data. for people who don't know what that is, these are basically paid respondents. People like big companies like Dynata and others maintain these panels. And we're able to get quick responses and get those responses matched to our file. And then that file we're able to then use to model out. So that has been invaluable because it allows us to turn around these kinds of models. Now, what we'll also do in working in tandem with Haystack is we'll go out there and we'll say, okay, we don't have a hurricane. Like there's there are certain topics where it's you're looking for what's the question? What are you trying to solve for essentially? And natural disasters, it might be, how concerned are you about global warming? Maybe this is something that's changed your mind on it, or maybe there's been a shift in that kind of opinion. What we'll do is we're constantly now in a state of fielding those surveys. So we're constantly just putting out to do QA on the models. But if we see a major shift, Haystack will come back to us and produce an updated model, and we will update it in the file. Now, we haven't seen that yet, but it's very possible in the next couple of weeks that happens, and you might see one get pushed into LiveRamp or pushed into data mapping.
Fascinating to see under the hood of how this all happens versus me just calling you and saying, where is this?
We try to make it look really pretty on the front end, though. That's it. You know?
Well, let's talk about the elephant in the room. We've got, depending on what countdown you rely on, 26, 27 days until election. What is it looking like on your side to reach or build a voter model for the final stretch? With these final weeks, are we looking at the voter turnout plus what ballots have been already delivered, removing those people from different files? Talk us more through that and how your clients are looking to use your data now with, let's just go with 27 days left.
Sure. Well, you know, it's amazing that the nice part about election work versus commercial work, and we do a little bit of both or a lot of both at this point, but elections work has an end date, right? So people get squeezed into positions where they need to drive, they need to innovate or die essentially before the end of the race. And we've had a bunch of requests, interestingly, for splits in terms of early voting. Now, right now, what we're looking at is early voting turnout. Who's the most likely to show up early? Are they going to vote by mail or are they going to vote by in person early? And then you have election day voters put out separately. So you've got these different boxes that people are broken into. We've recently gotten a number of requests for specific states, looking at California in particular, as well as Pennsylvania, where the consultants and campaigns that we're working with are saying, hey, can you do a 2 weeks out and a 5 day out most likely to show up at the very end of cycle, or a late early turnout model? Which is interesting. It's not something we have modeled from Haystack, but we have the data from historical, you know, information from 22, from 20, from the primaries, from off-year elections. So right now we are constructing an internal model state by state to be able to give people a better picture of the last 2 weeks and the last 5 days out, because those are people who are still reachable. You can still reach them, maybe by mail, certainly by digital. And so we're saying, yeah, we'll build those audiences, we'll push them out to you and make those available. I will be talking to you about those as well to make sure that your clients have them. But that's definitely going to be one of the things that people are looking for in an age post-COVID, first presidential, post-COVID election, where we have early voting has been it's understood now in Pennsylvania. I live in Pennsylvania. It's understood here now. It was not in 2020. It was totally new. For the vast majority of the states. So now that we have that information, it's definitely, you're seeing the turnout shift to early voting, and people want to know, okay, who are these people going to be in the last couple of weeks?
Yes. And that early voting, I feel as though just from, I'm old, I want to say TikTok, but watching some viral videos, really pushing people to, hey, you have no idea what's going to happen on the day of the election. Maybe your kid's going to be sick. Maybe you got to do this or that. Vote now. You've got spare time. Go vote now with all the early voting. So actually, to piggyback off of that, are there any specific techniques or data points that are standing out to you right now? People are reaching out or calling you and asking for, or say they can't find in their platform, in your platform, just out of curiosity. anything that you're like, wow, we haven't done this before, or there hasn't been that much traction on this segment before, but we need to keep an eye on it because more than a few people have asked for it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so there's definitely been a few. I put out a piece the other day in our newsletter and on our website about ballot switchers, or people who will choose maybe a Republican presidential candidate and a Democratic senator or a Democratic governor. So ticket splitters. And the ticket splitter model that we have has been the most popular single segment that we have. Now, it's always been at the near the top of the list. But in an age when people think, hey, everything's tribal, it's just about turnout, it's get out the vote, just go after your base and fire them up, I think what's becoming very apparent now is that, especially with demographic splits, and New York Times, Wall Street Journal, others have done extensive research on this, they've looked at men, both black and white, trending towards Trump, women, even Republican women trending towards Harris. So you're seeing these sort of weird shifts of demographics that don't necessarily align to R&D. So people are saying, okay, so how do I reach these people? Well, it's persuadables. So looking at persuadables in states like Virginia and Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin, those key states, is definitely one that we've seen a huge, huge uptick in. There's also looking beyond partisanship and straight vote history. Vote history is always going to be critical. Partisanship has become less and less critical. But it's been more of a socioeconomic look. And one of the key factors of that, obviously, income, education, part of our consumer database. But we've also, this cycle, well, actually back to 22, but this presidential cycle, we added urbanicity. So that's urban, suburban, rural. Going after rural voters has been key to both of the presidential campaigns, as well as a lot of the down ballot races. So finding people in different sort of demographic areas and socioeconomic areas has been much more utilized. And what's funny about this is it's not just national and statewide campaigns doing this. These are school board races. These are places that if you, again, I live in the Philly area, but even if you look in the DC metro area or even New York metro area, you see these sort of areas where you have extreme sort of, some districts will span from extreme urban areas to rural areas. So you have a lot of diversity in there, not just of race, but of everything. And so people are looking at those different socioeconomic, urbanicity, and ticket splitter type voters to try to find sort of a magical combination of who can I persuade here at the last minute, who's a leaner, who I can lean on to show up for me.
That's very fascinating. And that you're seeing it at the local level. I think when we talk about a lot of this, it's very focused on the national level or the state level or congressional, even down the state ledge. But to be talking about this at the local level for school boards and mayor's races in small towns, big towns, that's what I find fascinating.
Yeah.
And hopefully our listeners do as well. Okay. So there's a buzzword that's been around for a while, hyper-targeting, whether that's hyper-local or hyper-targeting as far as these are the few hundred people I want to reach and send this message to. And personally, as someone who's been doing this for 18 years, all in the digital space, I understand. I understand the logic. I understand the method and why people want to do it. However, there is a point where you over-target and miss your audience. And so I have a complex relationship with the word hyper-targeting. But your take on it. What does it mean as far as voter engagement from what you're seeing people use it as? And is it giving campaigns the strategic advantage? I have my two cents out there. I think it should be a tactic that complements your overall strategy. I don't think you should put all your eggs in that basket, but I'd love to hear your point of view on that.
Yeah, I mean, this is the time of year where we will get requests and it will be, oh, I want pricing and counts for my whole district. And it'll be, okay, what's the district? And we go into it and they go, okay, now I just want women under 24 who have voted in the last 4 out of 4 elections, which they weren't even eligible for, and all these other things. And you go down the line and you end up with 8 voters at the end of the day. And they're like, okay, those are your 8 voters. We highly recommend not over-targeting. Use the data. The data is great. And whether you're using 100,000 or 50,000 or whatever, you want to find the right people and you don't want to turn people off. That's really what, you know, should be your first thing, do no harm. And then your second piece should be, after doing that kind of analysis of, okay, who are my voters, remove the people who will hurt you if you reach out to them, and then go for that remaining bucket and try to keep that bucket almost as big as possible, because you want to be able to go in there and find people who are both, you know, the tip of the spear voters and then those persuadables together to give you that robust audience. And especially in an age, and you mentioned earlier in the conversation with threats of cookie deprecation and where match rates are going down and regulations are driving potential things out and people can't be targeted, you want to make sure you still have a robust audience when you're getting to the final stage of your outreach, whether it be mail or digital or texting or whatever, because you're only going to have a limited number of contacts. Even for direct mail, there's limits. So you have, I think, in a world where you can target like a sniper rifle down to a single, you know, person or individual, you shouldn't. You should be thinking much more broadly and making sure you're encapsulating and bringing in those people. And that's where modeling, regardless of who you use, use modeling. And what modelers have done is they've built in not just scores, because a lot of people think, oh, I want the 95 plus or 97 plus voters that fit pro-life, pro-choice, that are pro-Harris, pro-Trump, whatever it might be. Well, really what you can also do is either broaden that using the score, or a lot of these modelers have created flags, and the flags encompass broad swaths of 15 to 20%. And the analytics firms have done a good job of basically saying, here's a nice big bucket of potential voters or likely voters in your category, and you can take those and reach out to them.
So on that note, you mentioned texting, and there's not really a question here. It's more of a statement. Is, I think texting has arrived this cycle. I know it's been around for the past few cycles, but based on my personal phone, texting is here.
Yep.
But let's just touch on AI for a second. What are you seeing AI being used for, whether it's on the modeling of the data or helping your clients take the files and optimize outreach strategies? Is that something, or are you having a lot of conversations, long story short, are you having a lot of conversations around AI and data this cycle?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, it's obviously it's in a lot of people's worlds, whether they're using Copilot or they're using ChatGPT or anything like that. It's a lot of content creation, searching, things like that. That's the conversation I think most people are having with AI. Working at a data company, we've been using machine learning for 10, 15 years. So it's been part of who we are. I wouldn't say it's as advanced AI as you've seen in the last 2-3 years, but we're starting to implement that as part of QA processing and other things like that to make sure that the file is as correct or as accurate as it can be with a lot of those nuts and bolts things that we do to make sure the file is really clean. So that's sort of our foray into it, has been essentially expanding upon what we've done for a long time. But I know a lot of people are looking at AI as a potential future modeler, essentially, or building something in. It's a very interesting conversation, and we're going to be doing a lot of testing around it. I know post-cycle when we have a little bit of time to breathe, but it's definitely something that we are interested in, our clients are interested in, and using it to essentially take what you, because, I mean, Facebook does this. Meta does this. You can load an audience and you can basically find other people that look like that audience. You can do build lookalikes. So is that possible to do outside of that walled garden ecosystem that maybe you can't even advertise on anyway? So like, is that possible? So that's what we're looking at right now to see, hey, maybe if you have 10,000 supporters, match them to an L2 voter file, let's find 100,000 more. How do we do that and do it without, do we need a private modeler right now? Yeah, you would want to work with, and I still think that's going to be your best way to go for the next probably 5-10 years. I wouldn't doubt it, but the way technology is moving, I think those modelers are going to start to really implement some of these sophisticated AI techniques to be able to really hone in the models.
Well, with a few minutes left, let's really end on a high note or a bang, if you will. Ballot returns. Let's talk about the ballot returns, the speed at which they're coming in, and how fast the data is being refreshed to exclude those people from targeting.
No. So early return data is fascinating. I've learned a lot about it in 10 years, watching the difference from 2013, 2014, when we were seeing like 12, 13 states with substantial enough returns. Pennsylvania would have 700 people who were all people either in the military or disabled who would vote early, but very few outside of that. Now we're looking at massive returns nationwide. As of this recording, we've got 2.7 and a half million returned ballots, 79% of those mail, 21% early in person. And some of the big states, obviously Virginia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, are among the biggest that are actually returning data. So you've got a lot of information coming back in. I think this is, we knew it after 2020, it was going to reshape how practitioners are going to target. And I think now for the first time, and I mentioned it right off the top, you asked about new audiences, those 2 weeks out, those 5 day out individuals, those are critical now because we have the data from 2020 and 22 and the primaries and the local elections that have all been doing early return data to basically say, oh, these are your higher propensity early return voters. These are the people who do it 2 weeks out or 5 days out or whatever it might be. So that's been a huge piece of this. Now, it's really important when you go on your Secretary of State website, they're going to say X million have been reported. They basically take the envelope, they scan it, and they say that's a return from Paul Westcott or whoever. And so they'll count that. It doesn't get to our file or any of the data vendors you're working with's file for potentially a couple of days. There is a little bit of a delta there because of the fact that they have to put it into a specific format and put it into the file. So sometimes people see the Secretary of State public number versus what we're reporting or others are reporting. They'll go, well, wait, what's going on here? Because we're looking at individuals. Once those individuals are into our system, then we're putting it onto other platforms, including LiveRamp and Snowflake and other places, as well as our data mapping tool, where you can essentially remove those people that have already voted and use that as a suppression. And basically, these are people who are done. They've already turned in their ballot, and you can say, we're taking those people out. The other piece that's nice in an age where you have millions of people returning a ballot, you know, still, I mean, we're saying, oh, there's only this many days left. Well, you know, there's a lot of people have already returned those ballots, and you're going to see tens of millions more in the next few days and weeks. And you were still going to be 2 weeks out from the election. You're going to have a lot of data on which to build and say, okay, so who are these people? Who is actually showing up? You're seeing a big jump in our modeled Republican voters in Virginia. So you're seeing that. And so Republicans are like, hey, we're still behind Democrats, but not by as much. You're seeing larger turnout among young people in California. So that has implications for some of their ballot initiative work. You have, and the targeting they're going to be doing right at the end of the cycle. You're seeing in Pennsylvania a large uptick in African-American voting versus where it was in 22 and 20. So in early voting, so maybe that's going to shift strategy a little bit. So it's a little bit of, yeah, you want to remove those people so you're not wasting money, which is probably the most important thing. But secondarily, you're also able to look at it and do some analysis.
Well, one final thought here. So just so our listeners understand, when after the election, your job's not over. You guys now collect all the data and refresh the files and we start all over again, right? So kind of how long is that process and when is everything updated, and any other thoughts that you'd like to close on before we go down the final stretch of this cycle?
I have already had calls and emails about when we're going to be returning the general 24 data. And I'm like, can we please just finish this one first and then we'll get...
This was in lieu of the email I was going to send you.
I'm waiting for it, Jackie. I know it's coming. It is a process. And I think this year it's going to be protracted in especially some of those swing states where you're going to see lawsuits and a lot of pushback. And it's a tight election. There's no poll that says it's not a tight election in those, especially those seven swing states. And it's going to come down to specific counties in those states. So the hand counting and all that stuff is going to, it's going to come into play. So I think there's going to be some delays based on that. Our data acquisition director, Liana, who definitely deserves a shout out and probably a drink this time of year, she is amazing. Her and her team have gone out and they've maintained relationships with these secretaries of state and they're the county boards of election for L2's relationships for decades. And they have returned a ton of data, this like early return data, and they're already putting in the request for the G24 information. And because we want to make sure we're getting it as quick as possible, there's sort of the statutory window. And I looked at the actual timelines. Most states should have everything returned by middle of December, beginning of January. That never happens. It almost is always going to be January, February, March. And you know, the states you really, really want, those are the ones that are going to take just a little bit longer. Going into an odd year, you're looking at mayoral races and other state races. So people are looking for that, but they're also looking to see, how did we perform? How did we do? Which I love as an industry. I love that we're doing that. We're doing that sort of look back. And you've been a leader with that, Jackie, where you're like, how did we do in 2022 and 20? And making sure that our targeting was impactful. And you can see, okay, this is where we saw the biggest lift. So we're going to try to get them back as quickly as possible. We know the states people want, so we're going to work on those extra hard. But at the end of the day, it's not quite a hammer to a nail type process.
Well, I need you to start with Montana.
Do you want start with Montana? Well, we're going to just tell me, give me the list now and we'll go through it.
Got it. Paul, thank you for your time. Thank you for the wonderful insights. And this was a lot of fun.
Thank you, Jackie. Love talking data.
That was our chat with Jackie Hewlett and Paul Westcott. Be sure not to miss an episode. Subscribe to The Future of Political Consulting by the AAPC on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And join the conversation by following us on social media at the AAPC. Thank you for listening.